It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song.
How many of you have ever been to the zoo? Yesterday, you win. You did, you both win. This is a story about an odd trip to an odd zoo. It happened at school, and the class decided for their field trip, or the teachers decided they were going to take a trip to this very special zoo. When they got to the zoo, they only got to see one animal. And actually, that's not quite true either, because they blindfolded all the kids so they couldn't see anything. And then they took the first half of the class in to see this animal, and they had to put their hands out and feel a part of the animal. And what they felt was a huge ear, that big and thin and leathery, huge, big, thin, leathery ear. Then they went back out of the room. They never got to take their blindfolds off. And the second half of the class came in with their blindfolds on, but they didn't get to feel the same part of the animal. Instead, they took them around to the tail, and all they felt was a very thin, bony, long tail. Then they took them back out, and they went back to class. Well, once they were on the school bus and their blindfolds were off, they started talking about what kind of an animal this was that they'd just seen. And half of the class was very sure it's like a big ear. It's big and flat and leathery. It's like the biggest ear you could ever imagine. Very strange animal. The other half of the class said, "You're absolutely crazy. You people are out of your mind. It isn't anything like an ear at all. It's like a rope, you idiots. We all felt it. We all felt the same thing. It's like a rope. It's about that long, and it's hard. And it's a rope. It's not an ear, you morons." By the time they got back to school, the name-calling had really gotten pretty strong. And they had a recess period when they got back to school, and they were out on the recess arguing about whether this animal was like a big leathery ear or like a ropey kind of tail. And finally, a fight broke out. I mean, they got so mad that the other half had the animal all wrong that a fight broke out. And they were actually beating each other up over whether this was an ear or a tail thing that they'd seen. Now, there were some adult playground supervisors who watched this, but they didn't want to stop the fight because, after all, the kids were really passionate about it, and they thought they ought to be able to act on things they really believed in. Now, luckily, you should have stayed home today, right? There were a lot of them thinking that. But luckily, right about now, the Smart Patrol has arrived, and that's you all. And the Smart Patrol is going to figure out what should be done here. There's a fight going on in the playground. Half the group is sure it's an ear kind of thing that the animal was. Half is sure it was a tail kind of thing. Nobody ever got to see it. I think they've moved the zoo by now. You can't go back to the zoo and look again. I just made that part up. What are you going to do? What should happen? I suppose if they fight long enough, they'll beat each other silly and there won't be any more kids. That doesn't sound like the best way to do it. What do you think? Forget about the animal. Let's play baseball. Good. Good. What do you think? Thank you. Yeah, you want to go back to the zoo and let them see the whole animal, don't you? Yeah, that would be pretty smart. Source, I just made the zoo disappear. It's a what? Oh, my gosh, are you sure it's not just a big ear? Sure it's not just kind of a ropey tail? You can't be serious. You really think it's an elephant? So it's got to be an elephant. You're right. The end. You're right. Thank you for solving this problem. And you don't even know what you're doing? Uh-oh. Well, you're going to have to work that out with them. No fighting. All right, you're done. Go to class. This is an awkward Sunday to be preaching. I began with a sermon on Veterans Day, in which I wanted to ask what there is in us that keeps leading to social, political, and military fighting. Then the presidential election began to happen, and 5 days later, it still isn't done. Though here, too, we seem to be dividing into warring camps, often very self-righteous about our candidate and that other idiot, whichever one the other idiot is. People are confused and restless. I think that we are such a deeply hierarchical species that the lack of a clear leader drives us mad. That irrational actions are the sign that we need a leader. But dividing into social and political camps looks a lot like enlisting soldiers for battle. So I'll try the unlikely this morning by combining thoughts on Veterans Day, why we fight, our current post-election confusion, who we are, and what we are called to do. It's so ambitious and unlikely, I count on your forgiveness when I fail. I'll start and end this with stories. There was a poignant story on the front page of the Life and Arts section of the Austin American Statesman yesterday about a World War II veteran. I assume some of you read. It was about a Texas man living south of Austin, he's now 80, who had to leave the one true love of his life in France in 1941, never to see her again. It was many years before he even learned that she had died a few months later. He served in the war, came home here, had some marriages, but no lasting loves. And he still dwells in memories of 59 years ago and what might have been. He's worked in the movie industry on and off, and he's written a script about this story, which he's trying to get turned into a movie. And it might make a good one. We love stories of thwarted love set in wartime. It's the plot of Casablanca, maybe the greatest of all the romantic war films. The combination of war and love isn't as odd as it might seem. It's the most powerful combination in our history, and it's not rare. In Greek mythology, Ares, the god of war, was the favorite consort of Aphrodite, the goddess of love. And if you ever doubt whether the Greeks knew what they were doing with their gods and goddesses, which are really projections of natural and psychological dynamics, a lot of the doubt disappears when you learn that the names of the three children of the union of love and war were fear, terror, and harmony. Neither of those two gods was ever considered wise by the Greeks, though they were certainly powerful. But Aphrodite's loves were too local, too limited, and Ares was all rage and no reason. They were like the ear and tail people in the children's story from this morning. Like the other gods, love and war represented partial passions, too incomplete to be enough to live by, too powerful to resist. The Greeks had such good insight here. For when incomplete but passionate visions clash, they might produce harmony, but the odds are at least 2-1 that fear and terror are more likely results. I think war is a kind of mirror held up to us to let us see, if we will, some turbulent parts of ourselves. Or to turn that around, war is those turbulences projected outward from our psyches onto the stage of the world. But every clash of partial visions and half-truths seems to be an example of the same rule, a rule so deeply a part of us we have probably never been without it. The rule is very simple. It is this. We must enlarge. Mostly occur between ear people and tail people. Wars happen because we're trying to defend what's right and good against those who stand up for what's wrong and false. And on the other side, wars exist because they are trying to stand up for what is right and good against the idiots on our side who have got it all wrong. And it's important enough to fight about. If you'd been sitting up front this morning, you could have felt the ability to fight begin among the children. It's that quick and that deep. There are those few precious times. God, we love them when we think we found one. When we're convinced that a war really was about right versus wrong and all the angels were on one side. World War II was probably the only such war in the last century, though. Since then, our wars haven't been such proud affairs. When I think of war, I don't mean only fights between armies with guns. I mean all of the fierce confrontations between people who see different little pieces of reality and are willing to fight in their name. There's an old story about this. One day the devil's messengers, who must be very busy, reported to him that some people on earth had discovered pieces of truth. They wondered if the devil didn't see this as a serious threat. No, he laughed. They're only tiny pieces of truth, too small for wisdom. They'll turn those little pieces into orthodoxies, dogmas, and ideologies. Then they'll form armies to fight for their little pieces of truth. That's how I'll take over the world. Why do we fight? If it's a scientific question, it's an easy one. Like a million other species, we are fiercely territorial animals. We identify with our place and defend it against all outside threats. We wave our flags and parade our armies like other animals bear their fangs and arch their backs. And remember that a dog barks at you from behind its fence for the same reason that its owner built the fence. With humans, though, we've added a wrinkle. We've expanded our notion of territory to include conceptual territory. We live in our ideas and our beliefs. And we defend them with the same kinds of attack and defense strategies that we and other animals use to defend physical territory. A lion might kill another lion for infringing on his hunting territory or putting the moves on his mate, but he won't kill another lion for holding the wrong religious or political beliefs. That extension of territory to include intellectual territory seems to be our great achievement. That's what I mean by calling most of our fights a game of ear people against tail people. But there's a catch. When we're willing to fight and kill for our notions of right and truth, then unless we really know what's right and true, we become foolish and dangerous, like the story about the devil. And history shows us that we always seem to identify the truth with what we happen to believe. It's one of the most remarkable coincidences of history. I can hardly think of any exceptions to it. It would be amazingly lucky for us if we were right. Then, if we can't enlarge our understanding or our vision, we have to enlarge our armies. Seems the world's always been run by the outcomes of wars between one set of special interests against another set of special interests, won by the side with the biggest army rather than the biggest vision. When that happens, then the strong once more demand what they will, and the weak once more grant what they must. Time rolls on to the next act, which is much like the last act. One reason that the religious teachings of thousands of years ago still survive, while almost all the scientific teachings of 2,000 or 3,000 years ago have been forgotten, is because we've solved most of the scientific problems. But the problems addressed by the great religions, these problems are as much with us today as they ever were. And the religious answers that have been hanging around for 2,000 and 3,000 years have a stunning similarity. They often speak of seeking a God's eye view of the world, which I think must have to look something like that photograph of the earth taken from the surface of the moon. All one world, no boundaries, no divisions, no races. Lao Tzu taught 2,500 years ago to live in harmony with the Tao. He thought the way is a balance of light and dark and aggressive and receptive, sunlight and shadow, that everything is part of the whole, all tied in and interlinked. And we should live in a way that honors the whole rather than the isolated parts, because there aren't any isolated parts. Well, that's one way of putting it. Jesus said, "Seek first the kingdom of God." And that kingdom of God, Jesus was clear, was not something magical or supernatural, no matter what the religion founded in his name has taught. Jesus' kingdom of God was simply a world in which we treated each other as brothers and sisters, as children of God, and refused to accept any smaller or more local identity. It's the same message. The Roman Seneca, the Stoic, put it in one line when he said, "We are all limbs of the body of humanity." It's a wonderful line. And the task of trying to grow into our fullest humanity is the task of trying to identify with the whole body rather than just one limb. And perhaps the oldest of these teachings is still the ancient Hindu story of the blind people and the elephant, from which I took this morning's children's story. The elephant is life or reality, and no one can ever see the whole of it. That's the point of it. We can only see the parts we can touch or experience, an ear, a tail, a leg, or a trunk, and we think it must be the whole thing. There are more religious teachings on this, but I think instead of trying to milk these religious teachings farther, because it's so easy to get a mental disconnect between the real world and this old poetry of religion that always sounds about the same. Instead of that, I want to find an example of this kind of thinking, thinking with a bigger vision instead of a bigger army, one dealing with a complicated social issue rather than religious issues, and one that solves problems by transcending and including the different sides. This isn't just abstract, and it isn't irrelevant. If our current election is resolved, as it seems that it will be right now, with Governor Bush becoming our next president, we will almost certainly have several very important and very emotionally loaded social issues to examine or re-examine in the coming years, from abortion, affirmative action, individual rights, to restructuring of environmental and tax laws. We could use a model that's actually worked somewhere. To find this model, I'll move from the contentious subject of war to the equally contentious subject of abortion. About 14 years ago, a Harvard law professor named Marianne Glendon did a comparative study of about 20 industrialized cultures, including ours and 19 or so European cultures, comparing their policies among other things, abortion. Our country came out the worst in this comparison. We had done the least to resolve the issues for reasons that she found easy to show. Her argument's a simple one. 35 years or so ago, all over the world, industrialized cultures began discussing some of the things involved in the issue of unwanted pregnancies. The discussions came about because all over the world, birth control pills became more widely available, and condoms, and abortions became more openly discussed as options. These discussions were going on across societies in many social circles at many levels. Religious beliefs, beliefs in individual rights and a woman's responsibility to the unborn life she carried, in a society's responsibility to care for unwanted children, in the things that a child needs to grow in order to have a shot at the kind of life we want to give our newborns, all these issues and more were being discussed in the countries of Europe as they were just beginning to be discussed here in the early 60s. Yet in Europe, abortion issues have never reached the intensity and hatred that they have here, because Europeans continued the public discussion several years longer than we did until they'd reached a consensus. In this country, our Supreme Court Roe v. Wade decision short-circuited the public discussion process that continued in European countries. It created a law before the society had finished debating the issues, so the law never settled in common ground. Because we wrote our law before we'd found common ground, our society's often been divided into the rigid ideological clans of pro-life or pro-choice platforms. This is the ear people against the tail people. This has been the American path. It isn't the only path. In European countries, on the other hand, people continued the open discussions until much more substantial compromises were reached. Now, most European societies have laws stating that the most important single consideration must always be the sanctity of life. But that doesn't mean what it means in this country. That concern for the sanctity of life, they say, has to be placed in a realistic understanding of the conditions of life, the social, economic, and psychological situation of the pregnant woman, the probabilities that the unborn child finding or not finding a quality of life we think fits something we want to regard as sacred, and the rest of it. The result's been that women in many European countries have access to abortion as liberal as our own. In Catholic Spain, for example, the government pays for legal abortions. Yet we don't hear of right-to-life people declaring war, barring the doors of abortion clinics, or murdering Spanish doctors who are providing abortions. Because they got what they wanted, they got the admission that life really is sacred and that the sensitivity to the sacrality of life comes first. It hasn't restricted the choices much. It's just made them parts of a bigger vision and dissolved the armies. It's avoided wars and murders in many European countries. It has resulted in lower rates of unwanted pregnancies, fewer abortions, higher adoption rates, and greater roles for societies in caring for unwanted children. If they're avoiding fighting and they're finding peace, they must be doing something right. And it's worth wondering what. I'll take only one case to make a point, though there are a lot of cases. This case happened in Catholic Spain. It involved a single woman who wanted an abortion during her 8th month of pregnancy. Under Spanish law, as under American law, the woman had to get the court's permission for such a late-term abortion. Initially, she had wanted to keep the baby. Though she was a single woman, was not planning to marry the baby's father or receive any support for him, and though she only worked at about minimum wage, she felt that she had no right to deny life to this baby just because it was inconvenient for her. But late in her pregnancy, she had amniocentesis performed, and she discovered that the baby she was carrying was severely deformed, both physically and mentally. It would cost a lot of money and take a lot of energy to care for such a baby, and she told the court that she wasn't capable of caring for such a child. Therefore, she wanted the court's permission to have the abortion. The court agreed. She obtained the abortion, and the government of Spain paid for it. But the court's reasoning made this issue part of a deeper and broader picture than we generally hear it discussed in this country. The court noted that even though Spanish law insisted on the sanctity of life, Spanish society, in fact, had not put its money where its mouth was. Spanish society did not have the ability to provide care for such a baby. They lacked the social services, financial support, and the educational and nursing services to provide any decent quality of life for such a child. And if the government was unable or unwilling to commit the money and the resources to caring for the child, they said, then it would be brutally unfair to expect a single woman to do so. Therefore, they granted the abortion. They hoped that someday Spain would be able to provide services for such children so that they could grow to live useful and happy lives. Whether Spain ever grows to that level and decides to allocate its money in that way, this is a framework that allows moral discussions and distinctions to be made in the abortion issue that I don't think we've learned how to make in this country. What I want to suggest to you is that Spain, like many European countries, has avoided the wars we fight over abortions because they were able to develop a bigger vision involving more facets of the issues involved in unwanted pregnancies. Instead of building armies, they increased the size of their vision. As this borrowing from Spain points to the kind of a solution that could also help avoid some social incivilities in many areas at home. So now I'm going to politics. I think in the times of what look to be turbulent social changes ahead of us, I don't think that political or social liberals have enough wisdom to guide our society adequately, and I don't think that social or political conservatives do either. The view of an ear plus the view of a tail still doesn't do much justice to an elephant. If we react ideologically during the coming changes, liberal and conservative camps will circle their wagons to try to keep short-circuiting the process by getting our kinds of laws passed, fighting against those other idiots. I think our instincts will push us to react like territorial animals. They seem always to have done that, to defend our position harder and help create the conditions of social hatred and violence. But we have a chance during the coming changes to try a different path. It's a path I want to try to recommend, especially to liberals, most especially to religious liberals, particularly to us. Soldiers die because of our failures of vision. They die mostly because we're like the ear and tail people who make big armies because we don't know how to make bigger visions. We don't want to see that those on the other side of almost all complicated and powerful issues are really our moral equals, our intellectual equals, and our brothers and sisters. We think we're right, they're wrong, and that the important problems of life can somehow really be as simple as that. And as long as our visions remain too small, we will have to create bigger armies. Then it starts all over. The next act looking much like all the last acts. And in every generation, people will find all those old religious teachings about peace rather than war and wonder why they still seem so apt. I went through a few of those visions earlier in Taoist, Hindu, Christian, or Stoic versions. I'm sure you know of more. But whether it's the kingdom of God, the way, the whole elephant, or the body of humanity, the same message comes to us through all the ages of our history, and I think it's a message we need now as much as we've ever needed it. We're still coming through a frustrating presidential election. By almost all accounts, these two men were not exciting candidates. Half the citizens didn't even bother to vote. We were frustrated with the choices, and no matter how it turns out, at least half the country will be frustrated with the results. If Governor Bush is finally elected, there may be some significant changes in our society in many areas. There's been a kind of incivility during the past decade that's unprecedented in my life, and the current bickering and viciousness seems to threaten even greater divisions. We are programmed, what some would call hardwired, to defend our territories. We'll be sorely tempted to do that again and to defend visions too small. I hope we'll resist the downward pull of stunted visions and seek instead to expand the horizons of discussion and debate on all the issues we have, on the subject of abortion rights versus rights to life. I hope we can work to frame the issue instead under the larger umbrella of how we can treat all these questions as moral issues whose roots go into our concern for the sanctity of life, as several European countries have already done. On the important issue of individual rights versus individual responsibilities, I hope we can insist that the two concerns must be linked together, for neither one alone is sufficient. On economic issues, I hope we can find and articulate the bigger umbrella. On the one hand, there will always be inequalities in income and opportunity, because there will always be inequalities between people. Greater gifts deserve, and will anyway get, greater rewards. But our laws and economic structures have to be used to encourage and reward gifts and character wherever they're found, not merely wealth and privilege, or we are undermining the moral center of our own society. On issues of religion and education, I hope we can see past the separation of church and state far enough to realize that we have to find a place in public education for the deeper questions of ethics, morality, and responsible living that have always been held as primary by the best religions. And in all the other divisive issues which beg us to become small soldiers for limited visions, I hope we will resist. We come to and from the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. We are the bearers of a proud, bright, and deep religious tradition that has inspired the likes of Thomas Jefferson, Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and others. We are meant to be among the intellectual and moral leaders of our community and our world. It is our gift and our calling, and I think it is our duty. In all these areas and more, rather than enlarging our armies, let us strive to enlarge our visions. We can serve our exclusive territories or our inclusive humanity. We can define ourselves by our divisive differences or by our inclusive commonalities. Let it be the latter. And there's an old Buddhist story that's on point here. A fierce soldier approached the Buddha one day, brandishing his long, sharp sword. "I am a mighty warrior, and I'm going to kill you," he said. "Well, then," replied the Buddha, "with that much power, you ought to grant me two final wishes." "Very well," bellowed the warrior, "but make it quick." The Buddha pointed to a small tree, a sapling, nearby, and said, "Cut off a small branch from that tree." With one stroke of his sword, the deed was done, and the warrior handed the severed branch to the Buddha. "And now," he roared, the Buddha handed the little branch back to the warrior and said, "Now make it whole again." It's reported in Buddhist literature that the warrior experienced enlightenment at that moment and spent the remainder of his days working to heal rather than destroy, to make whole rather than cutting apart. My friends, let us aspire to do the same.